Great leadership is about principles. From our work with hundreds of school leaders, it is clear that those who understand this are the ones who thrive. At Making Stuff Better, we create regenerative spaces. Whether these be through executive coaching, coach training, or our group programs, one principle is clear. The principle of belonging comes up time and time again. So with this in mind, here at Making Stuff Better, we are making 2023 the year of belonging. This show is a series of journeys we will take to explore what belonging means in an international school in the 21st century. What does it feel like? How do you create it? What matters most about it? And do we even need it at all in our schools? Join us as we discuss leadership stories from around the globe and uncover what belonging means today and why leaders may need it to thrive. By me, Matt Hall, and my friend and colleagues, Jill Kelly and Naomi Ward. Powered by Making Stuff Better. Hello, folks. Just jumping on because we are increasingly being asked by colleagues about how they might create more regenerative conversations in their setting. Similarly, lots of people are asking us about how they might bring coaching into their schools, or they may be asking us about how they might train as a coach themselves. Well, with that in mind, I'm delighted that we're going to be running a two-day online training in Prologue. Prologue is our introduction to coaching for educators, and it's going to take place on the 6th and 7th of June. It's for you if you know about the power of coaching, you want to bring a more coach-like being and thinking and doing into your leadership, whatever your role in your setting is. I guarantee it will be an enriching personal development experience and you'll really deepen your connection to yourself and to others. So you're warmly invited to join us. We'll be meeting online from 7 a.m. to 1 p.m. BST. Loads of breaks as we go on the 6th and 7th of June. The link to find out more and to book is in the show notes, or you can go to msbprologue.eventbrite.co.uk. And as an MSB podcast listener, if I can say that, you will get £50 off if you enter the code MSBpodcast as you check out. The training is going to be facilitated by Naomi and Jill, who also, as you know, host the podcast and are really, really good at this work. They really know what it is to coach. They really know what it is to work in schools. And the combination of those two things creates a really great training experience. It'll be really good fun, highly engaging, very interactive, and I hope hugely useful to anyone thinking about bringing coaching to their school or just looking to develop their ability as a coach themselves. We hope to see you there, but let's get on with this week's show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Principal Podcast. It's me, Matt Hall, and delighted to be joined this week with Naomi Ward. Hello, Naomi.
Hi, Matt. It's good to be here.
And really looking forward to today's discussion because we're joined by Brett Gerben, who's the principal of the Arbor School in Dubai. Naomi and I had the great pleasure of being there 6 months ago or so and getting a flavour of what the Arbor School is and what it stands for and how it operates. So, hi, Brett.
Hi there, Matt. Hi, Naomi. Lovely to see you again.
So let's jump in just for the purposes of everyone listening, and you'll do a much better job than I can of this, Brett. Tell me about the Arbor School and your role there.
Absolutely. So the Arbor School, as you've said, is here in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. We're 5 years young, but it's an exciting school, and it's a school that was founded on a philosophy, or what's known as an eco-sophy, which is a kind of deep green philosophy that says the world is a sanctuary, you and I are collaborators, not competitors, the best place for learning to take place is the real world, et cetera, et cetera. So when that philosophy was an underpinning start point for all the school, then the founders sort of said, well, what kind of endpoint would it look like if we educated in that way? What facilities would we need to educate in that way? What spaces and places? How would we teach? What would it all look like? And so that's really the sort of genesis of the school. And so the school itself is functionally, I guess in inverted commas, air quotes, you'd say a green school. It's greenish in terms of the spaces and places. But the idea behind that is not, you know, not a marked gap. It's the idea that children need to connect with nature. How do we connect with nature? We give them spaces and places in which they can connect with nature. And if they start to connect with it, they start to care for it. And eventually we could ask them to look after it and to save it. But it goes in that order. What does the teaching look like? Well, it has to be experiential. It has to be connected. It has to look at big problems. It has to be based in real life. And so the kinds of pedagogies that lend itself to that are are inquiry-based constructivist approaches as opposed to dialectic sort of traditional methods. It's not that we would do all of one and not the other, because I think the two can go hand in hand when done well, but that's the sort of preferred pedagogies that we'd go for. And our end point, I guess, if we do all this right, if our children go from curious and connected to full of passion and full of purpose, is that our children will go out into the world and be champions for a world of abundance. It doesn't mean that we teach about plants and animals all the time. It's not a botanical school, because lots of the things that children need to learn in order to be able to take action are about action competence, are about understanding how to break problems down, are about being involved in sustainability as learning, not just learning about sustainability. And so that's sort of how our school operates. It is a national curriculum school, so it teaches the British national curriculum underneath all of that. We have the same metrics for English, maths and science as a school would have in downtown London or Birmingham or anywhere else. So that sort of defines our what, but our how and our why are a little bit unique to us here in an urban setting.
Thanks, Brett. I mean, it's really interesting, and I know from seeing it, it's a remarkable place. I'm curious around the kind of origins of that philosophy, either kind of, you know, where does it come from and who decides to set up a school on that basis?
Sure. I think the setting up, because most schools in Dubai, a majority of them are profit-making ventures. But I think Arbo perhaps is, you know, ideally a little bit different, because it is purpose-driven as opposed to profit-driven. And I think that's a power and that's a strength that I'm in a really lucky position, because the founder and CEO of the group is an extremely intelligent man whose background is paleoclimatology. So he spent his time trying to figure out what the Middle East would have looked like, you know, thousands and millions of years ago. So he's very ecologically minded, very STEM focused, and the idea of what a school could be, I think, really resonated with him. When the group that he represents decided to build the school, you know, he I guess for me now, fortunate that he came up with this idea of really believed in an eco-Sophy, really believed in the transformative power of education when done in the right way. And the three pillars that underpin our school then became sustainability, which is this ethic of enough for all forever. Eco-literacy, which is a little bit different from what most schools turn towards. So most schools that sort of would be like us might do things like sustainable education or education for sustainability. And they're not quite synonyms, which has taken a bit of learning. But eco-literacy is this idea is you should understand underpinning ecological concepts in order to build sustainable human futures. And all the bits of that are important, because simple things, ecological principles like a flow of energy, is really important, and the connectedness of nature is really important, because an ecosystem is resilient in its diversity. It's resilient in the number of links. It has emergent properties that the sum of the whole is far more than any of its parts. So eco-literacy is a little bit more pointy in terms of our way of getting towards sustainability. And the third pillar, which in all honesty, we haven't really addressed to my satisfaction yet, is about social justice, global environmental justice, which in a nutshell would say that you and I should share equally in environmental goods and environmental bads. But we tend to, certainly in the developed Western Northern Hemisphere, as we tend to enjoy all of the environmental goods and outsource all of the environmental bads. And I don't think we'll ever get to a point of sustainability, environmental justice, until we get to social justice. The two are going to go hand in hand. And so, yeah, I think it's a long-winded way to say how we got there. Our pillars of sustainability, eco-literacy, and global environmental justice, and that was founded by our CEO.
Yeah, hearing you, Brett, talk about resilient systems, the properties of resilient systems, you know, in the many, many links, the diversity, the quality of those links. I'm wondering how you as principal create that in the culture or the interactions across your system.
I was just doing some reading on this morning. So there's loads of things that are really complicated, right? Like an engine, a car engine is complicated, but we can, if we've got enough knowledge, diagnose it, we can intervene with precision and we can fix it. That's a complicated problem. Schools are complex, adaptive systems. All the bits are dynamic. They are kind of, to a degree, autonomous in how they act. And then it's not until all of those things go together that you end up with the final product. And then not only that, is they have, I think I said, they have emergent properties where you can only create conditions for these things to happen. You can't really build them. You can't predict them. You can't intervene with precision. So culture, I think, is a good example of that. You can either let culture define itself, or you try and create the conditions for a culture to emerge from your school. So how do you, as a school leader, create the conditions. Well, I guess that's in how you act. It's the structures of the school. It's where you apply your resources. It's what you model. It's definitely who you recruit. And so you kind of have to be on everything all the time in terms of saying, right, if I do this, it's going to affect that, but that's also going to affect this, and these things are going to affect over there. In reality, there's a little bit of, at some point, just sitting back and going, I'm not actually in control of much, but I can influence all. So I've got all these balls in the air that are going to come down at some point. I'm influencing each one of them. I'm pulling all the strings and pushing the buttons. But in reality, I think you kind of live in the gray space where you're just somewhat hoping that it comes down, the balls land in the right spot. And then if they land in the wrong spot, you throw them back up again, hope someone else catches it.
I mean, it's really interesting, Brett. And I think I know one of the questions that will be on the lips of our listeners is, you know, that's all well and good, sounds great, but, you know, what about the normal stuff that schools are required to do? Specifically, in, you know, your part of the world, when there is quite a, you know, clear inspection framework and expectations around provision. Yes. How do you do that?
Well, firstly, it's not easy. Anything where that is complex for teachers generally means work. But I can't in my mind see how having a happy and engaged and holistic and experiential education is juxtaposed against being really good at English, math and science, geography and history. Like, those two things cannot be at odds for sure. So our what, like I said at the beginning, is exactly the same as any other school that follows the national curriculum. It's the how and the why that then changes the sort of delivery of that thing. So we spend a lot of time trying to cover our bases in terms of making sure that we've got good coverage, making sure the children are hitting the same benchmarks as might be expected elsewhere, but then also trying to sit back and say age-related expectations are a national standard. They're not definition of a child. So we try and meet them where they are, which is a constructivist approach, try and individualize or have a sort of adaptive, responsive program in the classroom to make sure that they're pushing forward from that point. But I'm committed to it. And I guess as a teacher, if you had a leader that said, look, you've got, this is the luxury of being where I am, I guess, you've got small classes, supportive leadership, more or less unending resources, pretty good behavior, a really high level purpose. If I said that to any teacher, they'd say, hang on, that's teaching utopia. Where's the catch? And so I guess the catch is I want that, but I want Great English done, covering our ecological principles and concepts through the process of inquiry in the biodome. So when I give you that, that's the complexity I'm asking for. So I want my pound of flesh, but I'm prepared to say that this is the right place to be if you really want to take on the challenge.
Mm. And one of the things I was really curious about and wanted to talk to you on this series about is how your school and that philosophy, where belonging sits in that. And not necessarily what that means to you as an educator or as a school, but I got a real sense of that, of when I was there, around that fostering a sense of more global belonging. And I know we talked quite a bit about kind of the systemic thinking that you use in your work. And I was just wondering if you could speak to that a bit.
Sure. I think like most schools, and we would sort of say we're only just coming out of the startup phase. When you start with big ideas, you know, and you describe it and you lay your vision down on the table and your mission and all the values and the other adjectives that describe what you want to be, you end up with a lot of adjectives. We want to be curious, problem-solving, world-beating innovators, and this enormous list of adjectives sort of adds up, and then you try and separate them out into these, the eight we really care about, these, the eight that sit on our website. So one of the first tasks we started doing when I came in was to try and get some coherence in that language, to try and get a consistent message. So we started boiling it down. And then what we realized partway through is that we've got whatever it is, half a dozen different words that we think describes us, but we're not really teaching them, or they're unteachable, or certainly unmeasurable if we are trying to teach them. So those are sort of three questions. What's out there that says this is how you can teach these things to allow your children to thrive, and this is how you're going to know if you're doing better? And so when we started thinking about that, it was kind of clear that you can't focus entirely on the cognitive and leave aside the emotive. They have to go hand in hand. You know, you're not going to get great learning if children are disengaged or they don't feel a sense of belonging. So we started looking into different approaches to what I guess you would call social emotional learning. And the approach we've settled on, which I know is gaining traction globally, is called positive education, which comes out of positive psychology. And that, as I'm sure you know, said, look, if we clinically can take people from being unwell to well, surely we can take them from well to flourishing. And so we took the same concept. Well, if we can get people from unwell to well, then we should be able to go from well to flourishing. We should be able to teach children how to do that. And part of that, and adults as well, is teaching them that they belong to this place. So this place is really important. And at the same time, we said, well, look, hang on, if we're saying if you're not well, you're unwell, clearly then if we're not sustainable, we're unsustainable. And if we're always only heading for sort of status quo, then every time we fall back, we're either unwell or unsustainable or unjust. So we then had to recalibrate everything. So we said, well, if being well is not enough, what's the next level? And so we're shooting for the stars, heading for flourishing, human flourishing, maximizing and optimizing human potential. Sustainability is not enough because you can sustain a pretty poor situation for a long time, as we can see right now. So we actually want a world of abundance. So what do we need to do? How do we teach? How do we live? What do we need to know to be in a world that is more abundant? And then the same for justice. Well, actually, justice, if you're not just, you're unjust. So justice is like bare minimum. We actually want a world of harmony and equality. So we recalibrated what we were aiming for and said we're aiming for a world of human flourishing, a more abundant planet Earth, and a society that lives in harmony. So those are pretty lofty goals, as you can imagine. You try and boil those down into something you can actually achieve. And so if you come all the way back to the belonging side of it, it is trying to create a place where people feel they belong. So you create community, meaningful community for families. You leverage the communities you already have. If we've got 20 people that come from Italy, then you leverage that. You say, right, this is what we can offer to that community. So it builds communities within communities. And then you try and have, for me, a fidelity of vision. So if I can put into one sentence what our vision is and what it means, then how far down the sort of layers of a school does it go before that's not happening? And then my job is to try and push it all the way down so that there is a fidelity of vision. Once people believe in what they're doing, they've got that purpose and that autonomy, and then they start pushing towards mastery. But that for me builds a real level of belonging. If people believe in what they're doing and they feel that they've got the ability to influence it.
Yeah, and I can feel the energy in your words, Brett, as you talk about, you know, abundance and flourishing. And 5 years into this journey, I'm wondering what that looks like for the children, you know, who are 5 years into their journey with you. And I know that your curriculum moves towards finding purpose to make that transition out into a meaningful life. What are you seeing in your students?
Wow. That is a question that we ask ourselves consistently, because some things we're really good at measuring in teaching and education, you know, how kids are progressing in learning, how kids are progressing in academia. What's really difficult to understand is that this change that I'm looking for is not just head, it's not just heart, right? It's all, it's a head, hands, and heart journey. It's skills, knowledge, dispositions, and willingness to act. Skills and knowledge, but we can do quite easily. So we could test their green knowledge, if you like. What do they know about systems and ecosystems and biology and geography? Dispositions is what we're working on through positive education. So, you know, their zest for life, their appreciation of unity, curiosity, their creativity. And one of the powers of that process is that you can measure those character strengths. So we're not there yet, but we're leaning into how we know if our children are improving, and then their willingness to act is a really, really difficult one. Because most people, you know, if I said to you, do you like, you know, do you think you should pick up rubbish? You'd say, yes. I say, would you pick up rubbish? And say, yes. Do you pick up rubbish? Most people would say, oh, I'm not sure. So there's an implicit change in people, which is really hard to measure against the explicit change. So we're engaging with some universities to look at that, and we are actually building our own sort of center for excellence that will look at assessing change and measuring change to a deeper level. On the surface, if I was walking around in my school, what would I see, what I feel, what would I hear? It's a really happy place. Children smile, the relationships are fantastic. And it's not that we don't have challenges day to day with behavior and bits and pieces, that's a part of a school and growing up for children, but relationships are respectful. Children are kind to each other. There's a diversity and an inclusion level here where it is just the norm and it's appreciated and it's a part of what we do. There's a reverence for spaces and places, I would say that. So we have a giant tortoise that roams. You could, in many schools, probably see him flipped on his back, or imagine maybe graffiti, write your name on the side of his tortoise shell. But they treat him with real care, and he wanders around and we read stories to him and have snack time with him. We have Poppy the dog, our well-being dog. She walks the hallways, and children would rather have as a reward for good behavior a day with Poppy in their classroom than, you know, sweets in a movie. So in terms of children, they really feel like they're a part of something. I get a sense they do. I would be hard pressed to put a number on. Staffing is always a challenge because hard work, you know, this is a hard job. when it's hard, it's tiresome. And so I would hope that people feel a sense of belonging, because the metrics I have is that people want to be here. So I don't, you know, I'm lucky, touch wood, I don't have a problem with recruitment at the moment generally, because people want to be here. And so you have a low turnover. By and large, people are reasonably happy. By and large, people will apply to come here. So I guess the metrics I have are those.
Yeah, and I'm wondering how this fulfills you and your pathway to a job like this that's blending the traditional and the emergent.
I mean, I've drunk in the Kool-Aid, if I could put it that way, and I do. I'm struggling to find a way out of it. Not that I want a way out of it, but I am so engaged with this idea of a more abundant world, a more beautiful world that we know is possible. We just have to get through the despair bit before we get out the other side and start to really make inroads into it. My background is environmental science. I studied zoology. I stopped eating meat and went mostly plant-based or vegan a while back. I'm a bit of a greenie. I grew up on the beaches. So it wasn't a long journey for me to say this is the right way forward. But now I'm really trying to make sure I keep my focus as a school leader on what the school needs. But then now I'm finding myself thinking, okay, what does our mission need, which is a slightly broader category? And then actually I'm sort of now starting to think, what does the world need? So my vision is sort of scoping out. So I'm super engaged in what the school's trying to achieve. And I cannot see it in me that kids can't have this fabulous learning experience where they walk out of here with a smile every day and get good at maths and English and science and geography. Like those two things cannot be at odds. If we can't get those two things at the same time, then something we're doing is wrong. And I don't think anyone is going to say that having happy, engaged, curious kids is wrong. So that means something else is wrong.
Mm.
So yeah, I've drunk in the Kool-Aid. I don't know what I'm going to do next.
But when I think of that Kool-Aid, it reminds me a little of that the kind of part of belonging that we've discussed before on the podcast around belonging to self, and how often, I think Catherine spoke about it in our episode on Green Shoots in Vietnam, about actually, you know, giving children the opportunity, or individuals the opportunity, about choosing which parts of the world and of their experiences they identify with, and kind of create, allowing them space to create belonging that way. And again, I guess my sense is that that is something that's really present at Arbor, in the sense that they are maybe taught, and there is an environment there that makes them think about their role in the world and their role, their systemic position in the world, in a way that maybe goes beyond a traditional geography curriculum or citizenship curriculum.
Yeah, I would like to think so. I guess what we've done quite carefully with, you know, a few experts is to think about the sort of human scale of what you're trying to teach. Right? So I think I've said to you before that we have a rule of thumb that says no disasters before age 10. Because if you take an eight-year-old and you introduce them to, let's say, the burning of, you know, native forests in Amazon Basin, yeah, an eight-year-old can't solve their problem because it's really, really complex. And so they end up with this dichotomy where it's black or white, you know, farmers bad, animals good, which is fine. But actually, we know that there's a complexity to that that says there's so many different shades along the way. So that question is a bad question for an eight-year-old, because one is they can't deal with the scale of it. Two, they're emotively and cognitively not ready to solve it. So all they end up with is a learned helplessness. So then you have to scale it down and say, okay, for children of age X, what is their worldview? You know, a 3-4-year-old, their worldview is mummy, daddy, brother, teacher, and just that little place. So it's not really much point in giving them bigger challenges than that. So they need something that they can solve. So the questions and places and the things they should be learning to love are there, right on site within their world. Scale it up to, oh, maybe year 3, year 4, you can expand that little world. So now you start dealing with problems that are slightly more complex, but there's still to do in their world, and they're still here on this place at the school. So they're solving, how do we decrease the amount of waste we produce? Or how could we reduce the amount of water on site? Go up another year group and you're starting to talk about community or local environment or regional, and you keep going. So you can scale it up. So it's not really in my school until we hit about year 10 that the children start dealing with these big global problems. They start looking at, you know, global warming, or they start looking at social injustice, because they're emotively, cognitively ready, and we've built over time an ability to address problems in that way. So that's the systemic nature, I think, is saying that these, you know, if you, again, take an eight-year-old and say, right, go and inquire into global warming, A is they'll have a knowledge level that's really shallow, so they'll get it, they'll have a shallow level of inquiry. B is they'll be black and white. They'll be, you know, less or fewer nuances in their answer, because they're not ready for it yet. It's not that you can teach them about climate science. That's a different thing. But you would present them with a problem that's to do with a sphere that's outside of where they are. So that gives them that competence to act, and they don't have a learned helplessness, ideally. Now, obviously, we're not perfect at this yet, but we're getting there.
Yeah, and I hear that sense of experimentation and exploration behind the curriculum, and hearing you talk about the stages and how mindfully you're doing that takes me back to what you said earlier about getting through the despair. And what I hear is you're closing that knowing-doing gap.
Yeah, that's
like right from being young, they know enough to do enough, and you're walking through that, and that just feels very powerful.
Yeah, you're right, because actually, if you think of it in that sense, the knowing-doing gap. If the doing is easier, then you're more likely to do. So if we put the do closer to the know, then you're in a good position. So I haven't thought of it in that sense before. And if children can do, then again, their action competency, their willingness and knowing how to act is really powerful. I think the despair bit is important because you need an element of motivation to start, right? And so as long as the despair is not the end point, as long as there's a more beautiful world that we know is possible, this abundant world, despair is going to drive us. And hope, I forget who I read, said hope is the herald. We know it's there. We hope it's there, but we now, our role is to educate in a way that there's not just hope and there's not just despair. It's an ability to act. And so that's underpinned by a fundamental knowledge of systems, a fundamental knowledge of ecological principles, being really literate so you can be eco-literate, being fantastic at maths and science, because recycling is not going to save the world. It's our children go out, they're going to influence economic systems, and they're going to change in environmental architecture, and they're going to innovate and come up with solutions that will put a band-aid on some of these problems. So there's no getting away from being knowledge rich and having powerful knowledge, but it's how you use it, I think, it becomes really important.
So hearing you speak of that curriculum and its application just makes me feel like this is what the world needs. What's your perspective on that?
I'm going to have a job for a while. That's a good start point. What my perspective on that, we have attention, I guess, like most schools that are profit-making ventures, and that for us to achieve our mission, our vision, sorry, which is enough for all forever, for us to achieve our vision is I then need other schools to be more like me. You know, that sounds a bit boastful, but if I assume that what we're doing seems to be heading in the right direction, for the world to be more abundant, then I need schools to teach more in the way that I believe is right. And at the same time, if I put my business hat on, I'm losing all of my competitive advantage if I help other schools to be more like us. So there's a tension there. Thus far, we're a little bit unique, I think, in the environment in which I'm in, and people, families are attracted to that. My answer to that, I think, is you can't always be first, right? We can't be first to the sustainability initiative and first to this curriculum, first to that. You will never always be first. So the only way to do it really is to be best. And so think about our playing field and how we can continue to be awesome at what we do. And then people will come for that. If someone else wants to have a go at that, I'm sure they will be able to replicate bits. Anyone can build a biodome, which we have on site. But it's the sum total of the activities and the experiences at Arbor that will be different to another school. And that sum total of activities is our strategy. And that is unreplicable, because anyone can build a biodome, but I don't think many people would connect it to the kitchen, which is connected to the farm, which is connected to our chef, which is connected to project-based learning, which is connected to. You can't replicate it. So to be first is not possible. It makes it a race. To be best at what you do is possible. And I think that's how we answer the call of competition, you know, how what Arbor needs versus how what the world needs.
What a lovely place to leave it. And one, I think, a question, a real reflection for our listeners to think about in their context and part of the world. Thanks so much for chatting to us, Brett. Where can people find out more about you, if you want them to, and the Arbor School?
We're on every social media platform. So if you look up the Arbor School, or our website is www.thearborschool.ae. Arbor on LinkedIn, Arbor on Twitter, and Arbor on Instagram are probably our strongest places. And me personally, I spend a bit of time on Twitter, and probably LinkedIn is more where I am now. So on LinkedIn under Brett Gertman.
Great. And I'd strongly recommend people to follow the school and look for the updates. It's always really interesting content that you're tweeting and sharing. And it's always a real pleasure to talk to you and pick your brains on it. So thanks so much for your time.
More than welcome. Love to chat. And I think the one final notice there is there's an authenticity in the social media. And I think that's what sometimes people wonder, and you've seen it, that if you, what you see on our website and our Insta is what you see in the school. That's one of the things I'm looking for.
Absolutely. Thanks, Brett.
Thanks so much, Brett.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming along with us on this principal journey. To learn more about making stuff better and how we can help you and leaders in your school, please do get in touch through hello@makingstuffbetter.com. Alternatively, you can find us in all the usual places like LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. Links are in the show notes below. And don't forget to subscribe, and if you can, leave us a review. That's all for now. See you next time.